From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, the line of the day. That's the daily angle on the presidency that Reagan aides have fed reporters for the last 8 years, according to journalist Mark Hertzgard. In Hertzgard's new book, he says the White House, with the cooperation of a compliant press corps, rewrote the book on presidential image-making. Also, we continue our series of interviews with Fresh Air's contributors. Today, I speak with our book critic, John Leonard. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews a new recording of 13th-century Spanish vocal music. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg discusses the difficulty novelists encounter in writing good dialogue. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Mark Hertzgard thinks that political campaigns have become public relations campaigns. Image counts more than a candidate's stand on the issues. Hertzgard is an investigative journalist who has spent several years examining how political advisors manipulate the press to get the desired image across. His new book, On Bended Knee, is a study of the press and the Reagan presidency. His previous book, Nuclear Inc., investigated the men and money behind nuclear energy. In his new book On Bended Knee, Hertzgard maintains that the rules of presidential image-making were rewritten by Reagan's former White House Chief of Staff, Michael Deaver, and former Director of Communications, David Gergen. Hertzgard writes, quote, "They introduced a new model for packaging the nation's top politician and using the press to sell him to the American public. Their objective was not simply to tame the press, but to transform it into an unwitting mouthpiece of the government," unquote. Mark Hertzgard told me that he thinks this was done on the basis of a sophisticated analysis of the American news media, how it works, which buttons to push when, exploiting the press's weaknesses.
Well, I think in particular the distinguishing characteristic of the Reagan propaganda apparatus was that they realized that for television in particular, stories about the White House and about the president are commodities, and very profitable commodities at that. And this was central to their understanding that the media would take what they give them. Les Janka, who I interviewed for the book, was a deputy press secretary in the Reagan White House. And he said that the strategy that we used was essentially manipulation by inundation. And he drew a distinction between that and the strategy that the Nixon White House had used, which Nixon, he said, essentially tried to restrict access, keep information from reporters, whereas the Reagan people realized that, as he put it, the press will take what we feed them. If we come in there and give them a pre-masticated, well-packaged story every day in the format that they want, that they'll take it, and sooner or later they'll stop bringing their own stories and being an investigative reporter of any sort. I went to Mike Deaver and asked him about that, and he actually gave one of the best quotes, I think, in the book, at least to me, one of the most amusing. He said, you know, I think that's right. In fact, the only day I really worried about was Fridays, because it's a slow news day here in Washington, and if I didn't give them, that is reporters, if I didn't give them a story, they'd go out and find something. Well, tell that to Thomas Jefferson. That's not the kind of press that we're supposed to have in this country. The press is supposed to be aggressive and independent and a check and balance on the White House. And I think, unfortunately, during the Reagan years, it was too often a rubber stamp.
Well, now, you say that during the Reagan years, the public image makers wanted to control the message, to control the message going out to the press, and that there was even something that they called, or you called, I'm not sure which, the line of the day. Is that their word or your word?
That's their word, astonishingly enough. That's the kind of word that you would expect to find in totalitarian societies, and yet every morning, the White House, at the White House morning briefing, Larry Speaks, or whoever was the press secretary, would come out, and they had met at 8:15 that morning in a meeting called the Line of the Day meeting, and Larry would give the assembled White House reporters the line of the day.
What would a typical line of the day be? Do you remember what any of them were?
Well, none of them would tell me exactly what they were, but you could generally get a sense from looking at the coverage. The line of the day generally got through more or less intact. I remember during Grenada, one of the lines of the days was the second day of the invasion, that Bud McFarlane was quoted, the National Security Advisor was quoted as saying, "We got there just in time." speaking of U.S. troops on the way to Grenada. And the president, of course, then used that in his speech later that day. And that was the line of the day, that we, the United States, got to Grenada just in time to hold off a Cuban Soviet base there. Of course, it turned out upon later examination of the facts that there was little danger of the Cubans taking over in Grenada, but by that time the press had already bought the story and the American public was convinced of the rightness of the cause.
You also say that President Reagan's media advisors have limited the president's access to the press. Why?
Well, I think they, Sam Donaldson told me that the reason that Deaver doesn't put President Reagan out there answering questions is because he's ignorant of current events. And I think that's true. They realize that Ronald Reagan, when you take away his teleprompter, is basically an ignorant, confused man. And he will repeatedly put his foot in his mouth and say things like he did the other night at the Republican convention, facts are stupid things. Well, that's the kind of thing that repeatedly done, it gets the president in a lot of trouble. So they kept the president away from the press and just gave the press these carefully choreographed photo opportunities.
How did they keep the president away from the press?
Well, it just didn't let them have access. You know, the reporters in the White House are actually kept on a pretty tight leash. They see the president maybe once a week, and when they do see him, he's getting ready to get into a helicopter. They have to shout their questions, and the most that they get is one question to which Reagan can give a well-prepared one-liner. It's one of the things that he's best at, instead of making the president available under open conditions for in-depth interviews or press conferences.
Now, you've said that Michael Deaver was really a master of staging flattering photo sessions for the president. How would he do that?
Well, Deaver had a very good eye for color, for contrast, and for the kind of image that would be conveyed. He would, when President Reagan went overseas on trips, Deaver would go over sometimes as much as a month in advance and plan out exactly what kind of photos he wanted television networks to cover. So that, for example, when the president went to Korea in late 83, shortly after the Grenada invasion, Deaver had choreographed this in advance and had Reagan step up to the demilitarized zone and give a picture where he was in a flak jacket with field glasses on, staring across the line to the communists on the other side. And of course, it was a very flattering picture of the president. I remember Andrea Mitchell, the NBC White House correspondent, told me later that she was covering that once the president was there, and she saw that he had missed his toe mark when they were doing the story, and she saw one of his aides give him the high sign and move him over into the sunshine. So Deaver had actually planned out exactly where the sun would be shining on such a day so that it would have the perfect image to convey this impression of a powerful, strong, courageous leader.
Was this emphasis on image made because the image makers thought that that was a good way to communicate, or is it because of a bias that they see in the press that the image predominates over the word?
Well, I think it's both. They knew that Reagan comes across a lot better in how he looks than in how he speaks. And then also, of course, they recognize that, for television, what they care about is pretty pictures. And, it got to the point where one of the senior producers on the CBS Evening News told me that Michael Deaver should have been listed as the executive producer on all of our political stories in 1981. That's how pervasive the White House control was over what Americans saw on television.
My guest is journalist Mark Hertzgard, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, On Bended Knee, The Press and the Reagan Presidency. And according to Hertzgard, President Reagan's advisors rewrote the rules of presidential image making, and the American press let itself be manipulated. Let's talk about how some of these media techniques were applied during different parts of the Reagan presidency. Let's look at Iran-Contra, which was the greatest problem that the president was faced with in terms of stories breaking about his presidency. How were some of the things you were discussing put into play when the Iran-Contra story broke?
Well, I think the Iran-Contra story, you're right, was the instance of the most critical coverage of the president. I would say that this is something most Americans don't recognize, but in fact, the Iran-Contra story was around 18 months before it ever broke into the headlines. The New York Times, in particular, had the Ali North story on its front page in August of 1985. They did not name North, but they had all the essentials of the story, that the war on Nicaragua was being run out of the White House. But the story wasn't followed up. And this gets to another part of the book, not just how the White House manipulates, but how the press censors itself. I asked reporters in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times why that story wasn't followed up. And they explained that basically it was very clear that that was not what New York headquarters wanted. And I think that was related to the fact that reporters around the Times knew that the executive editor of the Times, Abe Rosenthal, tended to look very critically at stories that were critical of the Nicaraguan Contras. In 1983, so that would be, yes, 2 years before that, Mr. Rosenthal had removed a reporter of his, Ray Bonner, from the El Salvador beat after Bonner's reporting had provoked a right-wing backlash here within the Reagan administration and by its right-wing allies. So that's the first thing that I would say about Iran-Contra, which is that the press came to the story late, even though it was right in front of it. And then the second thing is that the press didn't really get its teeth into that story until the administration gave it to it, until Ed Meese came out in the famous White House press conference and said, "We've discovered that arms that went to Iran were used to buy weapons for the Contras." Only then, only when a government official had announced that the sky is blue, did reporters finally really get onto the story. That, I think, was, to get back to your question about techniques, that was a perfect example of the kind of damage control operation that Reagan's handlers had been perfecting from the first day that he was in office. If you are able to define what the story is in the way that Ed Meese did that day, you can limit the damage. And what in particular the White House did throughout the Iran-Contra affair was to try and narrow the focus of inquiry so that the issue became, did President Reagan know specifically about the diversion of funds to the Contras? When in fact, the issue should have been, what was President Reagan's involvement, and wasn't he responsible for this wholesale, unconstitutional, secret government that was operating within the White House?
Narrowing down a story, defining how the story will be interpreted, that's spin, right? Putting your spin on a story.
Yes, that's certainly one example of spin. And, of course, the other techniques that they used were to keep the press away from Reagan, to put him on television. Now, not all these techniques worked, I want to stress. You know, Reagan's first few speeches where he said, "We didn't trade arms for hostages," the American people saw through that. And in fact, it was going downhill there for a while in November. And quite a number of Americans, there was as much as half of the American public thought that Reagan was lying and that perhaps he should resign. And then Meese's press conference really turned it around, and it gave the White House some control over the future development of the story.
Let's look at the invasion of Grenada. There was a press ban that was in effect, and you suggest that part of the reason for that, you say you were told this by David Gergen, that part of the reason was you can't carry on a war anymore if it's shown on television, that they learned this from Vietnam, that people don't want to see Americans getting wounded. They don't want to see it on their television, so you just can't show it.
Yes, that was actually Deaver who said that.
And sorry.
I'm sure they both believe it. He said that we used to be able to do that during World War II with Ernie Pyle, and you go to the movie theaters on Saturdays and you see a newsreel, but every night in your living room we can't do that. So I asked him, I said, "Well, weren't you worried about a backlash from the press?" And he said, "No, I really wasn't, because the story was such a positive story that it didn't really matter." Well, again, I think he turned out to be right, but that was only because the press completely bought into all of the really deceptive claims that the Reagan administration made about the invasion, that the students were in danger. In fact, they were more endangered by the U.S. invading troops, that the Soviets and the Cubans were ready to turn Grenada into an outpost. In fact, they weren't. and so forth and so on. And yet the networks really played Grenada as the president's finest hour. And again, there's another instance of self-censorship. ABC News had the story of the Grenada invasion the night before, and they declined to broadcast it because they got a wave off from the Pentagon. An ABC crew in Barbados actually had footage of U.S. troops on their way to Grenada, and they had confirmation from the embassy there. They sent the story and the pictures up to ABC headquarters in New York, and with 1 minute to go, the ABC Pentagon correspondent, John McQuethy, called back to the office and said that he had been waved off and told that the story wasn't true. And unfortunately, the executive producer of the broadcast believed the Pentagon rather than the eyewitness accounts of his own reporters. And I think that gets to really one of the major problems that I tried to demonstrate in the book, which is that when in doubt, the press in this country tends to believe the government.
But you make it sound like it's an easy call, which I think it really isn't. It's a very difficult ethical call, isn't it? When you've called the Pentagon, they deny a story, or they tell you to sit on a story for reasons of national security. That is not an easy call to make.
Well, they did not. It wasn't for reasons of national security. That is a tougher call to make. I agree with you when someone says that for national security reasons, we can't. You shouldn't do this. That isn't what happened in the case of ABC. The information was never really accepted. It was a case where the Pentagon basically told a lie that was close enough to the truth to be believed, and the executive producer in New York bought that rather than what his own reporters had seen.
Well, there's a lot left to talk about. I want to talk with you about the current campaign and how you think these public relations techniques are being applied, if at all. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Mark Hertzgard, and we're discussing his new book on Bended Knee, The Press and the Reagan Presidency. And in this book, he outlines his view that the press played into the hands of the Reagan administration image makers. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Investigative journalist Mark Hertzgard is my guest, author of On Bended Knee, The Press and the Reagan Presidency. One of the ideas that you present in your book is that the Reagan administration had a set of image makers who created new ways of packaging the president for the press. And I think that you suggest that George Bush is actually carrying that on in his campaign now. I'd like to look at the current campaign and compare it to the Reagan-Mondale campaign. What similarities do you see in this campaign to that one?
I think there's a great number of similarities. I think that if George Bush learned one thing from Ronald Reagan, it was how to run a political campaign in such a way that you get good press coverage. One of the first things you do is hire Jim Baker. Baker is Bush's longtime friend and the chairman of his campaign. He also was the man who was the White House chief of staff during President Reagan's first term. And I think that Bush is essentially following the same model that Reagan did in 84, which is that you restrict reporters' access to the candidate and you provide very gimmicky, happy talk, photo opportunity type campaign appearances. Unfortunately, the press seems to be repeating its performance in 1984 as well and declining to smoke out the candidates and force them to answer tough questions. As it is, Mr. Bush and to a lesser extent Dukakis, who to his credit has continued to accept reporters' questions and made himself available. But Mr. Bush in particular, I think, is therefore managing to define the conditions under which he will be covered. And I think that's dangerous because it leaves the it lets him decide what kind of picture is going to be presented to the public, and as a result, he's not answering questions, for example, about the Iran-Contra affair.
Well, I want to ask you something. You suggest that the press is getting snookered by White House advisors and political campaigners, that they're accepting basically PR-type things that are put before them. But I have the September 5th issue of Time magazine in front of me, and this is over the whole brouhaha about whether school children should or should not be required to say the Pledge of Allegiance in the morning. So this is the opening of the Time magazine article about that. Prison furloughs, school prayer, and the Indiana National Guard are not matters that often cross a president's desk. But to campaign consultants, they are, quote, hot buttons that help voters define a candidate's character and values. So last week, while the national debt was topping $2.5 trillion, while a growing army of beggars wandered urban streets and America's overburdened school systems prepared for the return of classes, the electorate was treated to the spectacle of George Bush forcing Michael Dukakis to debate whether elementary school children should be compelled to recite a loyalty oath before they rattle off their ABCs. So there you are in Time magazine, you know, the big campaign story saying, well, this is all image-making stuff. This has absolutely nothing to do with what either of them would do if elected into office, but this is what they're talking about this week.
Well, I applaud that. I'm glad to see that Time does that. I wish they would have done more of it over the last 8 years, I must say. I'm speaking a little bit in broad strokes here because there's always some good coverage in the press. The press is not a monolith. And there are good reporters within it, and some news organizations shine at sometimes and others at others. Unfortunately, so much of campaigning these days is television, and even a major national organ like Time doesn't have the sway that it used to. And on television, you know, when Time writes about how the voters are being talked to about Pledge of Allegiance, that's happening over television. Television is really the main culprit here, and sad to say, there's much less room for decent coverage on television.
Do you think that television is more... the television is more readily falls prey to image manipulators than the press because they feel they're so dependent on good pictures?
Yes, I think they do. And also, what is television? Television is image, you know, so it only makes sense that they'd be more susceptible to that. You know, the rule about television is that what matters is the appearance, not the reality. And as a result, I think that they allow themselves too often to be taken over by the tyranny of the visual. There are ways to cover a campaign without doing that. You don't have to show the pictures of George Bush running through Boston Harbor or what have you. If the campaign doesn't give you what you want, you can get pictures elsewhere, but unfortunately, our television journalists tend not to think that way.
Well, if the campaign isn't making the candidate available, or if the White House isn't making the president available, what alternatives do you think the press has to get access to the decision makers?
Well, I think that they can do tough investigative reporting. They can do reporting. They can lead their broadcast, for example, by saying that Vice President Bush today again declined to make himself available for reporters' questions, preferring instead a photo opportunity appearance at such and such plant. Now, you know, I said before that the press has declined to smoke out Mr. Bush this fall, in the same way that they did Reagan in 84. And I asked Bill Plant, the CBS White House correspondent, why the press had not led newspapers once or twice with stories about the president's inaccessibility or led the evening broadcast. And he gave a revealing answer. He said that, well, we could do that, but were we to do that in order to smoke him out, that would be to depart substantially from the canons of how we present the news. Well, he's right about that, but I think that those canons are very wrong, because it allows the candidates essentially to decide how they will be covered.
Every day you pick up the papers or tune on TV, there's a new poll that is comparing how Bush and Dukakis are faring. What do you think about this emphasis on polls? Do you think it's happening at the expense of focusing on issues?
Of course. I think the emphasis on polls is idiotic. It's driven by ratings. By ratings, in a sense that the way that you get people to watch is that you cover it like a sports contest. Who's ahead? Who's behind? You know, the coverage in the, particularly in the papers, but also on television, of these campaigns has far more to do with tactics and how the candidate is trying to position himself rather than the issues. Let's take a look at what Michael Dukakis says about the environment. George Bush goes to criticize him. Let's look at Dukakis's record. How does Mr. Dukakis plan to pay for the programs that he proposes. Where does Mr. Dukakis get his money? Where does Mr. Bush get his money? What does Mr. Bush think about, what's his record on Iran-Contra, the 12 meetings or what have you? You know, there are issues after issues to be discussing, but unfortunately the press has bought into the same notion that is promulgated by the image makers, which is that the public doesn't care about issues. I think that's nonsense. I think that's cynical and patronizing of a great people. Our people do care about issues if you present them with them.
In your book, you suggest that President Reagan's media advisors rewrote the rules of presidential image making. Do you think that those rules have been permanently rewritten?
One hopes not. I prefer to be optimistic about these things. I think that the press, if it does return to first principles and remembers that that the American Revolution championed, among other things, the idea of a free and independent press, that they certainly can fight back against these sorts of restrictions.
Have you ever worked in the daily press yourself?
No.
Do a lot of daily journalists get annoyed with you for critiquing press performance when you haven't worked as a daily press member yourself?
I don't know, not that I'm aware of. I certainly consider myself part of the press. I do investigative reporting and have worked for magazines mainly. My father was an anchorman, so I've sort of seen it
really?
From from that side. And it's not really my cup of tea. I prefer to be a little bit more thoughtful and dig deeper. And that's not, unfortunately, investigative journalism is not something that is very highly valued at the daily newspapers these days. And I dare say after writing this book, I wouldn't get any job offers anyway.
Well, let me ask you this. You do investigative reporting. You criticize the press for not doing enough of it. When you do an investigative piece, do you feel like anybody actually pays attention to it?
I think that that's one of the problems with journalism and with politics in general. You can never know what effect you have. You know, a businessman at the end of the year can look at the bottom line and he either did well or he did poorly. Journalism doesn't work that way. You have to, in a sense, follow your own gut, follow your own instincts and your morality. And I think, frankly, that journalists worry a little bit too much about that. One of the reasons that... at least journalists told me one of the reasons that they stopped doing Reagan gaffe stories in 1983 was because they were getting a lot of pressure, both from their superiors and from the public. You can't worry about that. That's not the job of the press, you know, to say that that the public doesn't like this. It's like a brain surgeon saying that, well, I won't do this because the patient doesn't want it. The job of the brain surgeon is to tell the patient what is needed in the same way that the job of the journalist is to elucidate issues for the public.
As you continue to watch the presidential campaign, what are you going to be looking for?
Well, as you know, I pay special attention to how the what the public perception is, that is to say, how the press is covering them, what sort of messages get conveyed through the press to the public. The press has such an important role in our democracy. It is the voice through which the average citizen finds out what his or her government is doing. So I pay very close attention to that and try and see how good a job the press does of keeping these candidates honest and informing the public about what they're really up to.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's always a pleasure.
Thanks. My guest is Mark Hertzgard. His new book is titled On Bended Knee, The Press and the Reagan Presidency. It's published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Otis Williams. He was the founding member of one of Motown's top soul groups, The Temptations, and he's still performing with the group today. He's just written a history of The Temptations. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When John Leonard started reviewing books in the early 60s, he got his biggest thrill from reading them before anyone else did. But that thrill was surpassed when he grasped their power for moral instruction and insight. Coming up, I speak with Fresh Air's book critic about his lifelong habit of a book a day. It's one in our continuing series of interviews with Fresh Air's contributors. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of 13th century Spanish vocal music by Ensemble Alcatraz. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg looks at the challenge of writing natural dialogue. He thinks novelist Don DeLillo has succeeded. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Hurricane Gilbert hammered Mexico's Caribbean coast today with winds of up to 180 miles an hour. Communication with the area was almost entirely knocked out. Authorities say they fear the hurricane may have caused catastrophic damage. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from Mexico City.
The hurricane struck the Mexican coastline early this morning with torrential rains and devastating winds. The storm was centered on the popular resort island of Cozumel, just off the northeastern edge of the Yucatan Peninsula in the state of Quintana Roo. A spokeswoman for the governor of Quintana Roo said this afternoon that no information on damages or casualties is available, but that severe flooding has occurred. 50 miles to the north in the resort town of Cancun, ham radio operators reported today the hurricane has leveled slum areas where thousands of people live in cardboard shacks. In both Cancun and Cozumel, thousands of tourists and local residents were evacuated to special shelters. The entire area was put under a state of emergency, with military authorities taking charge of evacuation and other emergency activities. In Mexico City, I'm Tom Gelton.
In the African kingdom of Lesotho, South African commandos today stormed a hijacked bus, killing three hijackers and one hostage. Police said 11 other people were injured. The busload of nuns and children was commandeered by four gunmen yesterday during a trip to Lesotho's capital city for a papal mass. The hijackers had demanded a meeting with Pope John Paul II, who was on a 10-day tour of southern Africa. Campaign officials said today the second presidential debate between Michael Dukakis and George Bush will be held in Los Angeles. The date for the Los Angeles debate will be either October 13th or 14th, depending on the Major League Baseball playoffs. The vice presidential candidates will debate October 5th in Omaha, Nebraska. A presidential debate September 25th in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, had previously been announced. President Reagan campaigned in the Midwest today for Vice President George Bush. As Jack Tishner of member station WSIU reports, Mr. Reagan told an audience of Southeast Missouri State University students he brought good news for the economy.
The president says the nation has made remarkable progress in the last 8 years, pointing to July's lower trade deficit.
I can tell you the message is going out to every corner of the world. When America goes into the market to compete, we plan to win.
Reagan never raised Michael Dukakis' name in the address, but he likened a walk down the opposition's memory lane to a nightmare on Elm Street. He termed the Democrats wanting a strong defense the most radical change since Dustin Hoffman played Tootsie. The president then went on to St. Louis for a $250 a plate fundraiser for Bush. For National Public Radio, I'm Jack Tichener in Cape Girardeau, Missouri.
UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar today thanked the United States for pledging to pay hundreds of millions of dollars in back dues. But he said the world body still faces long-term fiscal problems. President Reagan yesterday ordered the release of $188 million in dues for the current and next fiscal years. The Secretary General said Reagan's announcement was a very positive development. There are 102 nations delinquent in paying their dues. Those nations owe the regular UN budget $602 million. The Commerce Department today said the U.S. trade deficit fell to a three-and-a-half-year low in July. The improvement stemmed mainly from a nearly 9% drop in imports. Exports, which have risen sharply over the past year, rose only 0.7%. The latest monthly deficit was lower than most economists had expected and sparked immediate increases in the dollar, stocks, and bond market. Stock prices did close sharply higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 17 points to close at 2100.46, advances leading declines almost 2-to-1. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Nonesuch record label has long been associated with medieval music, the avant-garde, and folk and ethnic music from around the world. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz says Visions and Miracles, a new Nonesuch album by Ensemble Alcatraz, combines elements of all three.
On the cover of Visions and Miracles, the new album of 13th century Spanish music by the Ensemble Alcatraz, is a painting of the Madonna and Child with Saint Sebastian and other saints. At first, it looks like a medieval Spanish painting, then like a Salvador Dali. It was actually painted 8 years ago. As their name suggests, this vocal and instrumental group that specializes in medieval Spanish music is based in the San Francisco Bay Area. But the twist is that Alcatraz is also an early Iberian word for pelican. It was an old belief that the pelican fed its children with its own blood, and so it was a potent symbol for early Christians, a myth debunked as recently as the 17th century by the great English author Sir Thomas Browne in his Pseudodoxia Epidemica, or Vulgar Errors. So the Ensemble Alcatraz itself combines contemporary points of view and scholarship with a devotion to early music and performance practice. This delightful album, however, wears its scholarship lightly. Most of the pieces here are from the Cantigas de Santa Maria, the ballad-like songs in the Galician dialect commissioned by Alfonso X, called the Wise, to praise the miracles of the Virgin Mary. These are fascinating pieces with some surprisingly comic overtones. The funniest one tells the story of the heretic who stole a beautiful picture of the Virgin and, quote, put it in his privy. Then he sat down there, and he made a great mistake, unquote. The devil kills him, and the picture is rescued by a good Christian who is surprised to discover that in spite of its unhappy surroundings, it still has a heavenly smell. The most beautiful cantiga narrates the story of the workaholic seamstress who sews on Saturday despite her promise to the Virgin not to. The Holy Mother paralyzes her in punishment and finally cures her at Chartres. The refrain, repeated after every verse, says, "Every promise that is made to the Virgin, it is just and right that it be upheld." Some of the songs are 10 or 15 minutes long, and they're all structurally repetitious. But there's a slippery shifting of rhythm and color. Besides which, the cantigas evidently derive from so many different cultural layers, Spanish, French, Muslim, and even Jewish, that they provide a continual sense of discovery. And the performances by the five-person ensemble are full of energy and variety, especially Susan Rhode Morris, the extraordinarily resourceful soprano who can sound like a recorder or a choir boy one moment and a peasant the next. The album also includes two moralizing church songs in Latin and a long, hypnotic, instrumental suite arranged from various melodies from the cantigas. Who can say if performers sounded like this in the 13th century? Could they have been nearly as good?
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Visions and Miracles, a new album by Ensemble Alcatraz on the Nonesuch label. This is Fresh Air. Today, as part of our series of conversations with our reviewers and commentators, we meet Fresh Air book critic John Leonard. John is one of this country's most illustrious book critics. He's a former daily book critic for the New York Times and former editor-in-chief of the Sunday Book Review section. He also worked as the Times' chief cultural correspondent. Early on in his life, he had to choose between the life of an activist or writer. But after a short time as a labor organizer and community organizer, he decided that what he did best was put together words. Besides reviewing books for us, John writes for New York Magazine, New York Newsday, Ms., and The Nation. Since becoming a book critic, he says he's seen a change in the way he reads books.
Well, when I started reviewing them, which was, my God, 28 years ago, if I've been doing it that long, I just felt privileged to be able to read the books, the new books, before anybody else had seen them. And as I did more and more of it, I stopped thinking about books as a gee whiz opportunity and started, one, taking books as seriously as a source of moral and aesthetic instruction, and also taking more and more seriously my role as a reviewer. You're reaching hundreds of thousands of people, and that may be the only word those people get of the ideas contained in this book. So you've got a gatekeeper function.
You write TV criticism for New York Magazine. Mm. Now, I once had a listener say to me, someone who didn't know of your other work and who didn't know of your former affiliation with the Times and all the places you've reviewed books, someone said to me, "You let a TV critic review books on your show?" And I thought that was really funny because in this person's mind, television and books were so totally incompatible. And someone who had something to say about television couldn't possibly have any interest or anything to say about books.
Well, I don't understand it. Television, for me, is a central fact of the American cultural environment. It's unavoidable. Not to think about it seems to me to be irresponsible intellectually. Now, to write about it, I'm not quite that heavy-handed because I watch television at least half the time for the same reasons other people do. You know, I want something that isn't going to demand an enormous amount out of me, and I don't want to leave the house. But because I am that much of a perfectly standard, average, conventional American in my approach to the talking furniture, it also helps me to pick and choose among new programs and say, if you like this kind of thing, you'll like that kind of thing.
One other resume question.
Yeah.
For any of our listeners who think that Fresh Air was the first time you were on radio, I will point out that back in 1961 to 63, you were the program director of KPFA, Pacifica Radio, in California. And that Pacifica is a small network of public radio stations that precedes National Public Radio. 2 years isn't that long of a time. What got you out of radio?
Well, it's more of a question of what gets you into it. I was out at Berkeley and Pacifica Radio, which was founded by conscientious objectors after World War II, was there. It was a kind of crash pad for bright middle class dropouts, and it was wonderful because you were allowed to play. You were playing with the airwaves. You were playing with ideas. I got a chance to learn all this machinery and to mix sounds and to have a lot of fun. But it was still that. It was a vacation from whatever the reality would be. And then I sold my first novel, and I thought, that's reality. Now, that's what I am. I was mistaken. But I took that money, I quit my job, and I went off to the woods in New Hampshire to behave as a novelist is traditionally supposed to behave, starve.
How long did that last?
About 6 months.
And
I ran out of the money.
I had
a year-old kid. You know, you can't live in the woods in New Hampshire on advances on first novels for very long.
You know, I just want to ask you briefly how you got from writing novels to criticism.
Well, the American public proved to be quite hard to please so far as my novels were concerned. I published a couple in the 60s, I guess three, the last one in the 1969, another in 1973. The New York Times came along and offered me a job at the Times Book Review, which seemed pretty close, or as close as I was likely to get to a writer's life, and that proved to be something that I could feed the kids on, and not something I at all regret. You know, I'm working on another novel, but it will not stun the world either. It's something that I do because I like that kind of writing. And something I know I cannot do as well as the writers that I recommend over the air and Fresh Air.
In a recent review that you did for Fresh Air, you were reviewing a book on the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, mm-hmm. and you revealed more or less in that review that you were a recovering alcoholic yourself.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you got into the kind of problem that I know a lot of writers get into in the solitary life of writing and the difficulty of facing the blank page mm-hmm. every day, if that had been a serious problem.
You know, all alcoholics rationalize their reasons for drinking or having gotten to wherever it was that we got. And writers are better at rationalizing than most other people because they use the language, so that we have embroidered a myth. But basically, you're just a drunk like everybody else. And after a certain point, you've poisoned yourself, and it doesn't matter why you were drinking or where you find the time or where you find the money. Then if you are fortunate enough to sober up, you discover your writing doesn't get better. It certainly doesn't get worse. It just gets a little quicker. But then the rest of your life tends to become more interesting. so that your writing then ceases to be just words and reflects something of a texture of a life that you've reclaimed.
When you were coming back to work again after mm-hmm. being ill for a while, mm-hmm. was everybody ready to receive you? Was there an understanding that you were?
Well, one of the signs of alcoholic behavior is I worked right through this.
I
right through it until I was hospitalized because I could no longer walk. So a whole lot of people didn't know about it. Now I didn't work as much as I work now, but I was meeting two weekly deadlines
right.
at a magazine and a newspaper. But you have to think how sick this is. My wife had left me. My telephone had been cut off. I couldn't put the checks that they were mailing me into the bank because I never left the house. The one thing I did was get my copy in on time. I've talked to a number of alcoholics who, the one thing they managed to do in the last stages of their of what they call their bottoming out. What we call our bottoming out is that, you know, they were getting straight A's at graduate school, or you know, they were doing something. You hold on to one thing, which may be the last shred of pride you have, and say, at least I'm doing that, therefore I'm not really as sick as they say I am. Look, I'm getting my copy in on time. It's insane. But yeah, there's, I mean, alas, for the given the nature of our society, there are very few newspapers and magazines, very few businesses, period, who haven't had a lot of experience with some form of chemical dependency or another, and people are getting a lot more understanding about it. I was quite eagerly and affectionately helped by people with whom I had professional relations. They were very good.
Another book question for you. Yeah. Have you always been the kind of person who took a book with you when you left the house, no matter
yeah.
where you were going?
Yeah.
When you were young, you did that?
Oh, always. Always. It was embarrassing when I was a kid first starting that kind of maniacal reading. I could only afford paperback books.
They fit in pockets better.
They fit in pockets better, but they had such lurid covers.
Right,
and I was such
right.
a serious little man, right, that I didn't want anybody thinking that I was reading something that was lurid. I mean, did you see, remember the paperback copy of James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man? You know, it's the half-naked woman on the cover walking in the waves. Now, I knew that wasn't what the book was about, so I would rip off the covers of the paperback books, but then they'd fall apart in my pockets. Oh, no, it's a panic. It's awful. You have to have a book wherever you go, not just because you want to read all the time, but because this is a world in which this is a world of lines. This is a world of traffic jams.
That's
this
right.
This is a world of everybody else missing their appointment. And you're being stuck, and I won't go anywhere without a book.
Okay. I thank you very much for talking about this.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Fresh Air book critic John Leonard. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
I guess extreme weather conditions are still dominating the news.
Yes, indeed, and Hurricane Gilbert is at the top of the news today. We have a report from Mexico on that storm that's being called the most powerful, one of the most powerful in this century. It came ashore on the Yucatan Peninsula, and bringing its 175-mile-an-hour winds. Mexican officials say, though, there is a little good news. They say the main force of the hurricane missed resort areas, Cancun and Cozumel. We also speak with a meteorologist who's been flying into the storm to get information on it. He says the view from way up there is rather lovely, although in a plane, everything's a bit bumpy.
Well, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's not easy for novelists to capture everyday speech patterns and write believable dialogue for their characters. But language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg says every once in a while, an author gets it just right.
Don DeLillo's new novel, Libra, has to be one of the most ambitious literary undertakings of recent years. It's a speculative reconstruction of the events leading up to President Kennedy's assassination, which tries to bring to life all those shadowy fanatics, spooks, and sociopaths that haunt the pages of the Warren Report. One of the most powerful tools that DeLillo has going for him is his uncanny ear for the rhythms and grammar of actual speech. For example, here's how DeLillo has Jack Ruby describe his childhood. You should know my early life, Brenda, which I'm still obsessed. My mother, this is the God's honest truth, I swear to God, she spent 30 years of her life claiming there was a fishbone stuck in her throat. Doctors, clinics, they searched for years with instruments. Finally, she had an operation. There was nothing caught in her throat, absolutely, guaranteed. And that's the least of it. I'm just showing you some idea. There are not many other writers who could bring off this effect, assembling characters out of pure syntax. Some others who come to mind are Elmer Leonard, William Kennedy, and especially George V. Higgins, whose use of dialogue can be almost operatic. It's a tricky business, managing to give the impression of actual talk without actually getting bogged down in the false starts, the hesitations, and the incoherencies that real speech is full of, but which look bizarre on the printed page. Still, it's curious that this should be so hard to do well. After all, language is coming in from all sides all the time, so that doing dialogue shouldn't involve a major research project like, say, describing the burning of Atlanta. Yet dialogue is just where most naturalistic novelists come a cropper. They get the clothing and the smells and the ambience right, but the speech comes out flattened, generic, with none of the quirks and idiosyncrasies that conjure up an individual voice. This is where DeLillo excels. For example, here's an FBI man in Libra talking to Lee Harvey Oswald after his return from Russia. "What we are mainly concerned if there are suspicious circumstances to inform us immediately of any contact." Or listen to Oswald's cellmate in a Marine Corps brig. "In my own mind, this is nothing to excite themselves. I don't feel there's any guilt to be handed out whereby I'm punished." This is nothing to excite themselves. It's the kind of phrase we might hear anywhere, but that most of us would never be able to recollect, much less make up out of whole cloth. Linguists know all about this effect. People process language without really perceiving it, even when it comes out of their own mouths. You tape somebody talking in a conversation, and he says something like, "Will Clark's not the kind of hitter that, you know, like he can pull the fastball." But when you show him the transcript, he simply refuses to believe that he ever said any such thing. And when you finally play the tape for him, he's genuinely startled and abashed, like someone who's just learned that he talks in his sleep. It's as if there were a discreet stenographer editing the records of memory, with strict instructions to ignore any ungrammatical remarks. It takes a preternatural attentiveness to language to overcome this editor. I don't know what technique writers like DeLillo or Higgins use, but Charles Dickens used to speak his dialogue aloud while looking into a mirror so that he could see the words issuing from another mouth. It's a nice example of how much artifice it takes to get nature right.
Jeffrey Numberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by country pop crossover artists Dwight Yoakam and Randy Travis. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Crossing Delancey. It's a new romantic comedy directed by Joan Micklyn Silver, starring Amy Irving and Peter Riegert. So I hope you can join us. We'd love to hear from you. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.